Hello and welcome to Science Spinning, the show with an Irish spin on science, with me, Sean Duke, live from the studios of 103.2 Dublin City FM, here in the heart of Dublin City. In a few minutes, we'll be exploring what exactly the science of geophysics is all about with our in-studio guest today, Chris Bean. He's of the School of Geosciences at UCD. Also this week, you may or may not be aware, is Nanotechnology Week. Nanotechnology being the science of the very small. Will it change the world? Well, that's the question today for Aidan Quinn. He's the head of nanotechnology at the Tyndall National Institute that's based in Cork. And finally, in Writer's Room today, we'll be talking stone. That is stone that's used in buildings primarily, with Dawson Stelfox. He's the editor of a new book, Stone by Stone. This is a book that describes how stone is used in many Irish buildings, mainly in the north of Ireland, it must be said, and how the increased use of imported stone, such as granite from places like China, is impacting on Ireland's local stone industry. But first up today, we're talking about geophysics, and I'm delighted to welcome Chris Bean to the studio. He's a geologist and a geophysicist, I believe, based in UCD. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks, Sean.
Right, so I guess the idea with this particular slot is that we take different areas of science and we try and explain them in language that everybody might understand. So geophysics, I suppose, maybe have a stab at a general definition or what it is.
Okay, well, as the word suggests, it's actually two words, geo, which means the earth, and physics, I think, is a word that everybody understands. So it's really the application of physics to earth problems. So things like how the rocks deep in the earth behave when you push or pull them, as we know that plate tectonics, things are moving around, so we have to understand what happens when you push and pull. When you heat them up, we know that the earth is hot inside, so we have to understand how rocks behave when you heat them up. Or when you rip them apart, we know that when earthquakes nucleate or when earthquakes happen, they tend to rip rocks apart. So geophysics is the study of the phenomena associated with these types of activity.
And of course, they're exciting things that happen in the earth or with the earth, as we know, like it's an active planet, and geological in terms, I mean. We have volcanoes, we have earthquakes, these kind of things.
Yeah.
So can geophysics be used to predict these things, or, you know, predict an earthquake coming or a volcano is about to happen?
Well, prediction is always a pretty tricky one. I mean, even the weather, and we have a lot of understanding of weather systems, we don't actually predict the weather. We would give what's called a weather forecast. So in other words, we don't say that today it's going to rain at 3 o'clock in the afternoon at this radio station. We say there's a likelihood or a chance of a particular level of rain over a certain time period. And in geophysics, we try to do the same thing, let's say with earthquakes or other hazards. So we don't say there's going to be an earthquake in Sumatra tomorrow at 3 o'clock, but we say there's a chance of a magnitude 7 earthquake of a given size over a given time period, maybe that's decades, in this particular area. So what it has been able to do is to tell us where the hotspots are, where the danger zones are, but still predicting the exact time and the precise location of individual events is elusive. So that's not possible quite yet, and may never be possible, in fact.
And the birth of this whole area, if we go back a little bit in time, geophysics or seismology, you know, the study of earthquakes, they're kind of linked, aren't they? The birth of this, or maybe in a very important event, happened here in Ireland, didn't it? Maybe you could just tell listeners about the Irish connection.
Yeah, well, we have what's called controlled source seismology. So that's not the seismology of earthquakes, but that's the seismology that we use, or the techniques that we use for sending sound waves into the ground to tell us what's below the surface. Just like pregnancy scans, for example, for looking for petroleum reserves and so on. And the first person in the world to carry out one of those types of experiments was a chap called Robert Mallet, an Irish guy who coined the word seismology.
And a Dubliner, we should mention.
Of course, on this station we should say he was a Dubliner. And he carried out the first such experiment in 1849 on Killiney Beach. So he was the first person in the world to carry out a controlled source seismic experiment.
So this essentially would be to figure out why earthquakes occur, because I think I remember reading that people had all kinds of crazy ideas that it was an act of God or punishment or this kind of stuff. So this showed maybe the scientific basis for it.
That's exactly what he was very interested in, earthquakes, and he wanted to understand why the ground shakes after an earthquake. So what he did essentially was he detonated dynamite on the beach, and some distance away he had a little bowl with some mercury in it, and then he watched the mercury vibrate in the bowl as the waves from the detonation traveled through the sands of the beach and came to the mercury. So he was trying to understand, if you had a big shock somewhere, like an earthquake, which is what was at the back of his mind, would it then send waves through the ground, shaking through the ground, that you would feel at some distance away? And he was proven right.
Fantastic.
It was the birth of modern seismology.
Just on stories where geophysics might be used, people might have seen on television Time Team. It's a very popular show where they don't seem to dig very much in archaeology anymore. I suppose they don't want to wreck a particular site, but they can use these machines where they seem to scan underneath the surface. Is that geophysics?
That is geophysics, and it's one of the big applications for very shallow investigations. And what's happening, say, in Time Team, for example, one of the big techniques that they use is radar. They send radar signals into the ground. It's the same type of radar that we use for detecting earthquake or aircraft, rather. And those radar signals bounce off objects with different mechanical or with different electrical properties, rather, in the ground, and those signals come back to the person who's sending in the signal.
So that's how they can determine, say, the difference between something hard like a path or something like that, or the soft ground around it.
That's right. It depends on the technique you're using. In that case, they're looking at different electrical properties. If they send sound waves in, they're looking at how hard it is or how soft it is. So you can use a variety of different techniques to look for different physical properties of the material. And it's a very, very quick way to have a look. You know, you can cover a lot of ground in a very short length of time rather than having to dig lots and lots of holes.
And I've also heard stories where police authorities may, if they've narrowed down, say, a very large area in a forest or something where they think somebody might be buried after a crime, that instead of digging up the whole area, you can maybe scan very quickly.
Yeah, the reason that works is that if a ground has been disturbed, then water gets in and it's a bit looser and so on. So then it ends up with different response to these signals than the normal ground around it. So it just has a slightly different property having been disturbed. So it's a very quick way to cover a large area, for example.
Okay, now maybe we don't have that much time, but maybe you could tell me a little bit about your own particular interest or geophysical area. What's your own area of research that... Or is there something else you'd like to mention?
No, that's fine. We work on a variety of problems in the group in UCD. We work on volcanoes, actually. So we're trying to understand what signals on a volcano actually mean. So when you put out instruments on a volcano, you can actually record ground vibrations associated with things that are going on inside the volcano.
What volcanoes do you study?
Well, we worked on Mount Etna. We've worked
Italy,
Sicily. Yeah, we've worked on volcanoes in Peru and in Costa Rica.
That's exciting work,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's good. It gets one out of the office anyway.
So you put instruments to monitor the activity. How close do you get to the volcano?
You can be right on the volcano, and it can be pretty scary sometimes, you know, especially if they're erupting. We've been on erupting volcanoes, yeah.
And do your nearest and dearest get worried when you're going to...
We don't tell them what we're doing. It's the safest bet.
So, sorry, is it important to get close then to...
It is, because the signals get distorted as they travel away. So you want to be as close as possible. The analogy in, say, medicine, for example, it's not a direct analogy, but is a cardiograph, although that's an electrical signal rather than a sound signal. You put instruments on to yourself, or the doctor does, to record what your heart's doing. He's all these little bumps and blips, and we look at the bumps and blips on these on what we detect, and we try to say what is going on to the plumbing system of the volcano as opposed to the plumbing system of a human.
Well, say, for example, something like Vesuvius there, which is still active, of course, it's near near Naples.
That's right, yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of people still live around there. So, using techniques like you, I guess I'm getting back to the prediction thing.
Yeah.
But could you say, hang on a second, there's some strange activity going on here, we should evacuate?
Or? Well, that's the goal. So you are listening, one is constantly listening, and if you see anything strange, then you have to, you know, you really concentrate hard on what's going on. It's a very difficult call for, and it ends up being the job of the civil authorities, who have to take scientific advice and then decide to evacuate. Evacuating somewhere like like Naples is an absolute massive challenge.
A couple of million people
would have to be moved out, and it is a very hazardous place and a massive challenge for anyone who would have to do that. So one has to be very, very careful about raising the alarm level, and yet at the same time you don't want to miss something.
Okay, and coming back to Ireland, we should mention Ireland now. I study geology myself, and we don't have volcanoes, not active ones here, and you know, maybe it's not as exciting as other places, but say for geophysics, what are the practical applications in Ireland for it?
Okay, so there are several, and it works at all different levels. So say in engineering, for example, if people are say in road building, one would want to know how deep is the hard rock below the proposed road track, because that essentially determines the cost. So you have a lot of soil, it's not so difficult to dig out. If you have rock near the surface, it's quite difficult. You use geophysical techniques to find how deep it is to the bedrock, to the rock, say for costing a project. So that's used a lot in civil
minerals
engineering.
Searching for mineral
exploration. We have one of the biggest, if not the biggest, lead zinc mine in Europe here in Ireland, in Navan. And so mineral exploration is a major area here for geophysics. Petroleum exploration offshore. Geophysics is used sending sound waves into the ground and looking for the echoes. Again, like pregnancy scans, the same principle. That's used for determining structures that might house petroleum. And in the renewables area, I mentioned the atmospheres are part of geophysics. Say wind prediction for wind farms, the sequestration of carbon dioxide, taking it from industrial plants and pumping it back into the ground. And looking for areas for compressed air energy storage from excess energy associated with renewable production and so on.
Well, listen, thanks very much. Sorry we don't have more time, but it's been fascinating. And thanks for taking the trouble to come in here today. That's Professor Chris Bean. He's based at the School of Geological Sciences at UCD. And he was doing a very good job in telling us about geophysics, the science of geophysics. Thanks, Chris.
Very welcome, Sean.
Okay, now in a new slot where did you see, I'm going to select each week some items that actually were of interest in the newspaper. This week, actually, something that caught my eye, it was in the Irish Times today. It spoke of how babies are born with the capacity to tell right from wrong. Now, the reason that this is interesting is that we did, up until now, we thought that babies were born like blank slates, if you like, in terms of trying to understand what is right from wrong. But in actual fact, it seems that from a very early stage, they've done tests on this, that the babies, very small babies, are able to discriminate between something that is morally right and something that is morally wrong. For example, one of the experiments that they did, where they had an experiment using puppets, and a ball was rolled to two puppets, and one of the puppets rolled it back and the other one didn't and ran away. So then when sweets were introduced into the equation and put in front of the two puppets, the children took the sweets away from the naughty puppets. So it shows that they do understand right from wrong. And this, we're talking about toddlers, not just toddlers, I should say, but children as young as 8-9 months of age. So parents out there, they do understand. Okay, now we're going to move on. We're going to move on now, and it is Nano Week. You may not know, but nanotechnology is a very important, what they call emerging technology. It's essentially the science of the very, very small, where we can manipulate atoms like never before. And to talk about this, I have on the line Aidan Quinn. He's head of the Nanotechnology Group at the Tyndall National Institute, which is one of the leading groups in this particular area in Ireland and indeed anywhere. So welcome to the programme, Aidan.
Thank you.
Aidan, first of all, nanotechnology. Okay, I'd say most people probably would have heard of it by now, but maybe try and just define it in general. What exactly is it?
Well, as you mentioned, nanoscience is investigating the properties of tiny structures and materials much, much smaller than anything we can see. So these would be 1,000 or even 10,000 times smaller than the width of a human hair. And these tiny structures have, from a science perspective, very new and exciting properties. So, for example, gold that you'd have in jewelry and wedding rings is yellow. You can make tiny gold spheres using chemical methods. These things would be, as I say, 1,000 times smaller than a human hair, and they're actually a red color.
Mm.
And even more importantly, these tiny little gold spheres called gold nanoparticles are actually used in products today. They're used in they form the basis for the most successful pregnancy test on the market today. What happens there is these tiny gold nanoparticles can bind to a hormone that's secreted in urine during pregnancy, so a drop of urine on the dipstick, and then the nanoparticles bind to the hormone, and then the hormone binding nanoparticles bind onto a strip on the reader, and you get a positive result that indicates pregnancy.
Okay, and I'm sure it's very, very accurate if it's nanoparticles being used.
Yes, well, I mean, because of the size of the particle, it can uniquely bind to the hormone. And it's got a specific coating on the particle as well, only to bind to that hormone.
Okay, can I ask you actually, just in a general question, I mean, how is it that now we're able to manipulate atoms or very, very small, tiny particles that we can't see, whereas, you know, not so long ago, I suppose, a couple of decades, we weren't able to do this. So how suddenly have we developed that capacity?
Well, some of these techniques have been developed over the last 40 and 50 years, but one of the big advances over the last, I would say, 10 or 20 years has been in the develop of new tools, new types of microscopes that allow us to see these nanoscale objects. And by seeing them, you can understand an awful lot about their properties. And that has come from, you know, these biomedical tests that I was just talking about, but also from things like, as the size of the tiny electrical switches and computer chips have got smaller and smaller. That's
sure,
a
yeah.
huge industry. That the techniques to make sure that these tiny switches were there, and there were lots of them there, and they're all doing what they're supposed to be doing, that sort of whole area of what's called metrology has also developed hand in hand.
Mm.
So if you like, the nano revolution is a convergence of lots of different disciplines that previously wouldn't have had much to say to each other.
Right, so you're talking about, I mean, you're talking about engineering, you're talking about the the semiconductor industry, health, all kinds of areas that it's impacting on. It's not just a specific area.
Exactly, because you can think of the nanoscale as this sort of common lens scale where all these disciplines are coming to talk to each other. So engineering, physics, chemistry, biology. So if you look at the tiny switches, the transistors, the tiny electrical switches that are the basis of every computer chip, they now have small features on them that are, again, 10,000 times smaller than a human hair.
And wasn't there was a breakthrough from Tyndall, one of your colleagues, wasn't it, recently, where they actually now have come up with a way with getting more and more transistors onto the chips, which essentially means we're going to have faster computers, right?
That's right. So Jean-Pierre Calange here at Tyndall developed a radically new type of transistor that's receiving a lot of interest from industry and also from scientists, because it works. It's developed a new way of effectively making these little switches work. Now, the conventional switches, as they get smaller and smaller, it becomes more and more difficult to make them work the way you want to. Mm. And this is a radically new way of doing that will require less processing. So effectively, it should make them cheaper or allow you to put more of them on a chip. So you can get even more performance on your laptop, on your mobile phone.
Okay, and isn't materials in general, I mean, that's a huge area for nanoscience or nanotechnology, because you do hear stories of, you know, that they're going to develop airplanes that will be much lighter, but they'll be made of stronger materials. So obviously, you know, they'll be stronger and safer, but they won't be burning as much fuel because they'll be lighter.
Exactly. So in the whole area of materials, there's new types of composites being developed. I mean, in some cases, you're learning a lot from nature there. For example, something like the abalone shell, which is very hard, and it's a mixture of an organic glue, if you like, gluing together inorganic, so oxide plates. In terms of coatings, a lot of this things we would see around as coatings on CDs, on, you know, iPod covers, all this sort of thing, you want something that will let the light through, be transparent, but also will be scratch resistant.
Sure, and I read again somewhere that they're developing, you know, TVs that you'll literally be able to stick onto the wall. They'll be so thin, you'll just kind of stick them up on your wall. So that's kind of nanoscience as well, isn't it?
Exactly, because there you're looking at the properties of molecules, polymers, chemically synthesized things, and looking how to interface those with electronics in, you know, a viable way to make a product.
Mm-hmm.
And one important point to stress there is that this has come about, there's a whole, if you like, ecosystem around this, and this is, you know, Ireland is actually punching well above its weight in the nanospace.
We're sixth in the world, is that right? Yeah. I read that
sixth
somewhere.
Sixth in the world in terms of publications.
That's very good, isn't it, for a small country?
It's excellent for a small country, and particularly when you think that this is on the basis of investment that's over the last 10 or 15 years by the government through the likes of Science Foundation Ireland, the Higher Education Authority, Enterprise Ireland and the IDA into third-level institutions and also into industry to really move Ireland up the value chain.
Sure. And can I ask you finally, I mean, there was a lot of hype there not so long ago about these nano robots or the, you know, these tiny robots that were going to go into the body, you know, move around and solve all our disease problems internally. I mean, is that just pie in the sky? Could that ever happen?
Well, I would say there's two ways of looking at that. There's the overly pessimistic view that Michael Crichton and people like that came up with in some of his books, which I would consider to have not much basis in fact. Mm. So there's the opportunities and the challenges. The opportunities are to develop new types of tests, new types of medicine, new types of drugs. And in parallel with that, there's a lot of research going on in academia and industry to understand if there are any detrimental effects associated with these materials.
Sure, because they're new materials.
Exactly, and the European Union are funding, and also the Irish government through the EPA, are funding substantial research to that, because effectively, nobody wants to come up with a new, ultimately with a new product that is going to be dangerous, because one, you know, it'll harm people, potential for huge lawsuits, and also the public won't buy it.
Sure. Right? Okay. Well, listen, Aidan, just run out of time, but listen, thanks very much for coming on and just giving us kind of an overview of nanotechnology during Nano Week, and I presume there's events going on around Ireland. I think it's nanoweek.ie, is that right, is the website?
Yeah, or NanoNet Ireland, I think.
NanoNet Ireland. Okay, thanks very much, Aidan.
Thank you.
We were speaking there to Aidan Quinn. He's head of the Nanotechnology Group at the Tyndall National Institute in Cork. Now, just a new slot that I'm going to do, 2050 I'm calling it, and basically the idea here each week is I'm going to select something that I think may have the potential really to change things into the future, some piece of research. I picked up Scientific American, which is a very prestigious American magazine. There's a story here that caught my attention, controlling machines with thought. So basically, we have for a couple of years, it may come as a surprise to some listeners, but it's been possible for a couple of years to actually have people's thoughts control computers and other machines. Now, these machines at the moment can do basic things, but you know that they can actually, for example, translate a thought into a word. So, I mean, the potential is enormous, obviously, to have thought control for machines if somebody is paralyzed, for example. But this article talks about going further, where actually the brain will be able to control a full body prosthetic. So, in other words, if somebody is missing an arm or a leg, or has they will be able to be wired up again, if you like, through the usual linkages to the brain, and they'll be able to control these new limbs simply by thinking. So this is very, very good news, of course, for people that are in trouble with various injuries and they're paralyzed, for example, or people that have lost limbs. And if we go even further into the future, it talks here about thoughts being transmitted as mental telegrams. So it'd nearly be like an email message that we could actually think something and it would get transferred through the ether, similar to an email message perhaps today. Anyway, so that's just a thought there. 2050, what it could bring. Now, finally today, in the writer's room slot, I'm going to talk now to Dawson Stelfox. He's the editor of a fine book called Stone by Stone. Describes the use of stone, stone conservation, and how the whole stone industry is changing here in Ireland. Welcome to the programme, Dawson.
Good afternoon, Sean.
So maybe you could tell me, Stone by Stone, it's a lovely book, nicely illustrated, and certainly it's very accessible to the lay reader. Anybody that might be interested in old buildings, for example, I'm sure they'd enjoy it. But what was your motivation to do it? There's not, you were the editor and you wrote some of it, but there was several authors, so you're all are mainly coming from an architectural background, I think. Why did you do it?
Yeah, well, I suppose the book has come out of a collaboration between ourselves as architects and the sort of, if you like, the academic side from Queen's University in Belfast. And that's a liaison that's been going back over about 15 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Started from really trying to marry up all the research that's being done in the universities in terms of the weathering of stone, and that's looking at ordinary buildings, churches, but in particular, I suppose, special monuments like the Celtic crosses, the Irish Celtic crosses, which are, you know, unique artifacts. And they're sitting out in the open air and they're gradually eroding with the weather that we have. So
what are they made of, Dawson? Are they mainly granite or limestone?
Some of them are granite, some of them are limestone, some of them are sandstone in particular. Mm. Sandstone would be a popular one because it's relatively easily carved, but sandstone also is subject to erosion as mm-hmm. well. And in the I suppose, in particular in the 1950s or so, a lot of these had got very worn, that some of them had collapsed and they were repaired. And back in the 1950s, there were metal pins put into them. Those metal pins, in some cases, are starting to rust now. And there's a huge debate amongst things, you know, should these monuments be brought inside to protect them, should be left outside, should copies be made, should there be glass enclosures put around them, all sorts of debate about that. And I suppose a lot of our collaboration was trying to understand the weathering processes. Now, that's one aspect of it. I suppose the other main aspect is that increasingly we've seen use of imported stones, and stones imported from China, from India. Mm-hmm.
That's the same in the south, I think.
And the same all over Ireland and all over Britain, actually, as well, and less use of local stones. And it seems to us a great pity that we're losing a lot of our traditions in terms of the use of local stones. So
that's an economic thing, I presume, Dawson.
In theory, it is. I mean, that's what we get quoted all the time. It's too expensive to use local stones. But in fact, we've just been involved in a process working with Hennigan Peng Architects, who are from Dublin, who won the international competition for the design of the new Giant's Causeway Visitor Centre up here in the north.
Oh, fantastic.
And what we've discovered as part of that is that we've got a quarry reopened for the use of stone. We've got the basalt out of that. It's been tested now. It's been put through all this, if you like, the international tests.
And it's basalt. Basalt stone at the Giant's Causeway, of course.
At the Giant's Causeway, but also, interestingly, it was cheaper than using an imported stone from basalt from China, an imported basalt from China. And that goes against what, if you like, was the instinctive things, if you like, a local stone would be too dear to use.
Of course, sorry to cut across you, but if we look at the island as a whole, I mean, there is quite a lot of different types of native stone, isn't there, in the different parts?
Absolutely. One of the fascinating geological things about Ireland, of course, is that practically every stone type is represented. We have grants up here in the Mourns, we have grants in Wicklow, obviously. We have very good limestones around Kilkenny area, great sandstones from all across the middle of Ireland and the sort of border regions. Up in the very far north, we have the basalts, and then over in Donegal, good quartzites, which are used for building as well. So we have a great range of building stones. But unfortunately, in a lot of cases, they've gone out of use for building. They're still used for, you know, churning up to make roads out of and things like that. But we've lost a lot of the use of them in building. And part of the purpose of our book is to try and, I suppose, re-engage the industry into thinking about the use of our natural stones in building. And that's getting architects to specify and getting clients to want them, getting public demand for them, but also getting the stone industry, the construction industry, geared up to using our local stones again.
Sure.
So it's not just the heritage buildings, which is obviously our primary focus, but it's getting them used for new buildings as well.
Okay, Dawson, I'm sorry we just ran out of time, but I would encourage people, if you're interested in this subject, and I think it's great, you know, we should be using our natural stone. It's called Stone by Stone. Can you get it in most bookshops, Dawson?
You can, yes, it's widely available.
Okay.
And it's intended as a practical guide to anybody working with stone.
Okay, thanks very much for coming on and telling us about that. That's the use of natural stone in Ireland. If you're interested in that and stone conservation, Stone by Stone is the name of the book. That's all we have time for this week, folks. Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to contact me here at the show, please get in touch by email at sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie. I'd love to hear from you. Or go to our website, indeed, which is sciencespin.com. I'm joint editor of that magazine, Science Spin, and plenty of material there. If you want to have a look at the magazine and sign up for free, just give us your email. Okay, so until next week, bye-bye for now, and thanks for listening.